All right, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Kristen L. from Wicked.
Hi, guys. I'm Kristen, and I'm an alcoholic. I am of the natural born variety, not the made variety. What it was like is I cannot remember a singular normal drink in my entire life. I grew up in a really great, great family. Lovely mom and dad were wound up married for nearly 60 years. Both of them came from really hard and dangerous and terrible alcoholic families. A month after they were married, they adopted my three cousins who were children caught in the crossfire of my aunt. And they later had my sister and then me. It was a pretty dry household. I had a lot of awareness about the program and certainly awareness about alcoholism, but there was a real sort of mixed message. Was a very Eurocentric family. My mother was super Slovenian. My dad had a lot of French influence, so giving babies water and wine was no big deal. It was only if your drinking became obviously embarrassing to the family that it was considered a problem. And so on one hand, it was just no big. And on the other hand, it was, oh, but so it was a really weird disparity. My first intentional drink was at 9, was super sneaky. Wine and the leftover beers from the parties were great, but I was more curious about what the off-limit clear stuff was. My dad was a banker in town, and he didn't drink, but everybody bought him alcohol. So our garage looked like a BevMo. And a lot of it was clear, right? So vodka, I drank at 9. It was the Bombay Sapphire Gin. I had largely replaced the arsenal of booze with water, all right? Very early in life. As the youngest of then 5, I was born, had a lot of learning disabilities. I was ADHD and dyslexic, and I remember feeling super dumb. And what was I going to do to get out of feeling super dumb and outdo all of my siblings? Because that was the game, right? Had to figure out where I was going to be in the lineup. And then a really, really interesting fluke happened that sort of changed the trajectory of my entire life and definitely made an imprint on my drinking, informed my drinking. My mother took me to a doctor's appointment with my sister, and this doctor's daughter happened to be the principal dancer of the Joffrey Ballet. And he looked at me and he said, notice the way she's sitting. Okay, she's got really good turn up. Point your feet. Oh, you've got good arches. And he said to my mom, put that kid into ballet. And my mom was looking for anything to keep me occupied. Anything. Because I was super hard to manage. So the ballet did a couple of things for me. I personally thought it was a complete snooze fest. I was bored. I was awful. It was just not my jam. I was much more of a tomboy and preferred to be building tree houses. But my little alcoholic ego absolutely loved all of the attention I got with little to no effort. And so I was off and running because I needed to feed that. I loved, right? And I was out doing all the siblings at this point. When I was 12 years old, the other thing about my alcoholic ego was that I didn't hear the word impossible. It just never occurred to me. And so I just shot for the moon and landed on it. I was accepted into the San Francisco Ballet School and left my home at 12 years old. And again, the disparity there was, aren't I fancy? But I was terrified. I was terrified. I had wound up causing one of the biggest fights in my family between my mom and my dad. My mom knew that I was absolutely unequipped for taking care of myself at all. I didn't know how to anything, right? Laundry, find a bus stop. Literally, that was the hardest thing I had done in my life, was figure out how to get to the bus to get to Meg Grisham in Orchid. And all of a sudden, I was plopped in the middle of, you know, Chinatown at 2 o'clock in the morning under the guise that I was going to be watched by chaperones. There were no chaperones there. Not a one. Never met a single chaperone. I drank to get down the hallway. Those girls were not nice. I was the scholarship kid. I was the poor kid. I walked into a world that was so out of my league, and they absolutely hated me. I could not function without getting drunk. I definitely was not about to get on the stage of the War Memorial Opera Theater. And it was just kind of out in the open. They had little ladies sitting at the wings with Tupperware containers filled with tuwaka, which is like this weird liqueur that no one's ever heard of. Who drinks tuwaka? Seriously. But I remember that feeling, and all of a sudden, I was like, okay, I can deal with this. I'm not going to fall down and crap my pants in front of 3,000 people. And so it was a win. And it just went on from there. And it very quickly took me down. I would go back and forth to high school, first Spaghetti, and then they would no longer work the ballet company, and so I went to St. Joe's. And so I would come back to town, and I had no way of identifying with you people. You know, the biggest thing, you guys were all dying in a field of alcohol poisoning at high school parties. And I definitely had to go back, and I didn't identify with that world. And so I just had no agency, and I had zero sense of self. And my self-worth completely hinged on what you all thought of me. If I got an applause, if I got a standing ovation, great. But if it was a bad night, then I just was hollow. I just didn't know what to do with myself. I literally had zero sense of self. And there was a lot of back and forth, right? You know, it was a different kind of normie. Non-ballerinas, I kind of referred to as civilians. And you all thought that I was too thin and too sick and I needed to gain weight. And then I would go back to school, or, you know, and they would not give me the part unless I lost another 10, 15 pounds. I didn't want to be anorexic, and I definitely didn't want to make myself throw up. And so the easiest way to get thin was for me to drink a lot, because it's really easy not to eat when you're super hammered all the time. And so that's the way it was. By the time I was 19, I was about 85 pounds, which is like literally about half of what I am now. And I just couldn't function. I didn't know where to go. I knew I was in serious trouble. My parents sent me to rehab for the second time at that point. Because they understood it that I had an eating disorder. And there was a nurse at that hospital that caught on to my game, and she was like, you don't have an eating disorder. This one doesn't have an eating disorder. This one clears up all the food that all the other ones doesn't eat. She's a drunk. And I was like, nah. And I ran around and played that game for a few more years. It took me to just get completely exhausted of trying to field those all that polarity in my life, right? And try to cover up all the lies in my life. The aunt that had the three children my parents raised, she had gotten in a really severe train accident with a vehicle, which is why she was taken out of commission and unable to raise her kids. But she didn't die. And in fact, she went on to really, really embrace the program. And so she took a shot at me, and I went out and I spent the summer with her. And she brought me to my first AA meeting. And I was not into it. There were like four people. There was the teeniest town in West Texas. I don't even remember the name of the town. I don't even know if it had a name. And there were like four people, and they had like four teeth collectively. And nothing that I wanted. And I was like, no, I'm set. Thank you. So I wound up pulling my first geographic. I bailed the ballet. Moved to Morro Bay, got off of vodka and cocaine. Drugs are a big part of my story. Vitamin C was what the ballet called it. And again, it was an open secret. Go up to the health clinic, kiddo, and get some vitamin C. My mom was like, oh! I just love that they take such good care of you. Yeah, so, and of course, I'm kind of backtracking a little bit, but I realized that this vitamin C stuff was really cool. I could steal it from the health clinic and come back down here and give it to all y'all at our little high school parties, right? That would help me fit in. That would help me get enough money so that I could buy booze, because again, I was stealing too much from the development office at the ballet. They were starting to catch on to my game. So anyway, I pulled the geographic and I went from vodka and cocaine, moved to Morro Bay, swore off the theater. We broke up permanently. I was never going back, ever. It was all the theater's fault that it had done this to me. Right. I became a surfer and a stoner and a sailor and really random. I was working at a coffee shop, and all of a sudden these two big, tall ships came up over the horizon. And I thought that it would be swell to sweet talk myself on as a crew on one of these ships, because I knew how to sail exactly nothing. My game was, I just wanted to surf the spots that you didn't have access to, right? The land side, I could get to like the water side. And it was fun to lie, and it was fun to just pretend I was in this different world and get away from reality. And I actually, in some level, I think thought that being a sailor would be the more sober option. And if anybody has met a sailor or a salty dog, that is not the case. So anyway, I worked on this ship for a while and was going up and down the coast of California to different maritime museums and surfing and still just as hammered off of beer, right? You just had to drink more. But I thought it would make my family happy because at least I was gaining weight. And I looked normaler than I was. I could pull it off a little bit better. But still not as great as what was going on up here. At some point, my sister, who lived in San Diego, had gotten in a really big accident. And I think my dad and mom were like, we've lost this one. Like, we got to do something to reel her back in. And so they asked me if I would leave the boat long enough to take care of my sister to recover from this accident. And I will never forget, I had gotten right from the boat and gotten on a train, and of course drank everything I could on the train. And when you're on a boat, right, you're never still. So, you know, you've got your sea legs. And then you're on a train and you're not ever completely still. And so you've got your train legs. And I'm drinking. And my dad's on the platform. And I hit the ground with my feet and just went down. Blew out my face. Yeah, and I think that was the day that I was like, I think I have a problem, Dad. I think I have a problem. So then the real magic started happening. I lived in San Diego, and I got a little apartment and didn't know anybody. And the lady who lived downstairs from me was so cool. She looked like she had walked out of an episode of Ab Fab. She was so fabulous. And there was always all these young people at her house. And they were always laughing and always together and just having a really great time. And I was like, what are they doing in there? What's the drug that they're on? Because I really thought that all these people were like doing some magical drug. And come to find out, they were all a member of Young People Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that was my entry point. And it was so much fun. Finally, I identified with people, right? I was having a good time. I was laughing. I can't say that I did a lot of step work at that point. But the fellowship was enough to keep me there. And as I went through this, I got curious about what these steps were, and I started working them, and I started listening, and I started rubbing off on me, and I started to feel a little bit better, and I had a little sense of self. So that's what it was like. Okay, what happened was I glommed onto that group with everything I had, and I was able to become me. A friend had asked me, she was painting a mural at the Copley Symphony Hall. And I walked into the Symphony Hall to help her paint a mural, right? And the orchestra was warming up. And I was like, oh, damn. The mothership was calling me home. Because I really do love theater. That's who I am. And so I was able to explore that and hung out with this group and got into scenic design and painting. And I was back with my people and started to feel kind of good and kind of alive and kind of normal almost. Here's the deal with me. I get about 8, 9, 10 years, and then I'm cured. And I'm busy. And I don't need to remind it every day. I mean, really, how dumb do you have? I'm not gonna forget it, right? So I just drifted away. And I will give you all one guess as to what happened. Relapse. So I've done that 3 times. And all of them correlate with a DUI. And it really sucks. And I remember hearing this, but I guess I just had to do the research for myself, that it really sucks to have a head full of AA and then go out and try to be a drunk again. It brought me right back to that place where I was in the ballet where it's like, okay, what world am I going to try to be in? Because I'm in no man's land. And I was just drifting. And I am very grateful that no matter how hard I worked to create separation between myself and the herd, you guys always pulled me back in. And so life was certainly not perfect. I think every single one of those tries, I took a more honest approach to the steps. I can't say that I ever really fully gave myself to this program. There were a lot of things I wanted to hold back. God, you can be in control of everything, but not my job. Not my family. When I became a single mother, definitely not my kid. She's mine. And so it was like 60%, 75%, 85%. And I was really good at intellectualizing these steps. In fact, I got too good at it because I could recite them and I could sound like I knew what I was doing. But I wasn't integrating them. And I remember that crazy aunt of mine saying, the longest distance call you're ever going to make is from your head to your heart, at 18 inches. And I remember when she first said it, I was like, what are you on, man? It just took me so long to really get that. But again, I'm really grateful that I got enough tries to keep plugging away at it. I'm acutely aware that not everybody gets all those tries. There's a lot of soldiers that fall along the way that can never get back. And if that's not enough to humble me, it literally brings me to tears that I always got back here. And especially this last time, life got extremely difficult for me. Sure, you get your pink cloud when you first get sober, but that doesn't last. And I hate to kill anybody's buzz who's a newcomer here, okay? But life, sobriety doesn't equal a fabulous life, right? Life's. This last, I'm coming up on, it'll be 4 years in August or whatever that is. Around that time, my father, who was my beloved, you know, daddy's girl, el numero uno, and he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's and he was going down that rabbit hole. It was extremely hard to watch and it was extremely hard to take care of him. But again, I was the youngest of five. And I had my mom, and so I wasn't going to be doing caretaking, right? Because the bigs would do that. The little didn't need to do that. And then everything really hit the fan. My mother came down with sepsis. She was hospitalized. We almost lost her. My next older sister got a brain aneurysm. My older siblings were just scattered. And so it was me. That kid I mentioned a minute ago, who I love with all my heart and soul, is special needs. And has a behavioral path that would scare the pants off of anyone. And so I was really over my head. I was really over my head. And I thought, well, I'm not going to do all this. There's absolutely no way. So my plan, I was doing some thinking. And my plan was that I was going to get a kick-ass job. Kick-ass job. Because my problem is not achieving. I can set a goal, and I will always hit the goal. It's just that will that I have as an alcoholic, right? And so I thought, I'm going to become a financial advisor. That's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to make so much money that I'm going to just be able to pay. I'm going to outsource. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a caretaker for everybody. And I did. And I went through this really rigorous interview process with this one company. It was like 6 months long. It was like the Olympics of interviews. And I got the job and started making plans. And I wrote down, I calendared my last relapse. Wrote it down. You deserve to drink. Yeah, that was August 20th. And my God is really funny, slightly mean, and gives me no room for error. Like, no, Kristen, you really can't drink. I am really not kidding you. So I had a hot 2 glasses of wine, and my mom called me and said, your dad's missing. And so I got in the car with my child and was driving around looking for my dad. About 4 miles an hour. I've never gotten a ticket for going too slow. But I did that day. And my third DUI. Which made a whole lot of mess in my life because my child was in the car. Thank God they didn't take her from me. I literally think I would have fallen over dead. They did not make it easy on me. It was a whole lot of money and heartache and mess. Just a mess. And I have to tell you, there was no pink cloud that time. No pink cloud. It just got harder and harder and harder. Okay? Alzheimer's doesn't get better. Autism doesn't get better. Brain aneurysms don't get better. So, and now I have to provide for my child and take care of all these people and hold down a job, right? And I just didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do, but I knew to not make any designs because my designs suck. So during a lot of that time, I was going to a lot of online meetings, no matter what it was. And I was so grateful that the hospital would always clear out a quiet room, right? Let me go in there because I was constantly in the hospital with one of them. I mean, literally, I had like a fast pass. They're like, Kristen, what's up? Who do we got today? I was like, dad, mom, kid, just a wreck. But they always made space for me to have a meeting and me being open and honest about where I was with every nurse and doctor and security guard really saved my bacon. And then being able to come back into the rooms, okay, which I had a little trepidation about. It wasn't only that I was too busy. The last time I was in these rooms, I wasn't a particularly nice person. I was a little dramatic. I made some waves. And so then I had to eat that crow, okay, and walk back in and get myself up back in this herd. And that scared the crap out of me. Really did. You guys made it so easy for me. I will never, ever stop being grateful that I talked to one of you at every single day of my life. And you all know that I have a lot going on. Again, none of the things got better. Dad passed. Mom lived. Sister lived. Kid lived. Kid was hardcore for a minute. Real hardcore. And then she came down with an autoimmune disease. Okay? And I damn near lost her about 6 months ago. I watched her drop about 40 pounds. Her eyes were like blood red. Nobody knew what was wrong with her. I was like, okay, what? And that was the one thing that I had reserved, right? Not my kid. And I remember being in the hospital. Sorry, I still get emotional. And I was like, oh my God, I might actually lose her. And that was the moment that I stopped intellectualizing these steps. And I got out of my head, Olaf, I can't go to the hospital anymore. I'm out of trips to the hospital. But that was a really magical night for me, and a night that it all switched. And after 30 years, basically, of really trying to get how these steps work, it was like, I got it. I felt it. I could be it. And I remember going into the quiet room that night and just meditating, because I never, ever wanted to forget that feeling. I wanted to just hold it as long as I could, because it took me a really long time to get there. And once I was able to really turn it over, life has completely shifted for me. Things remain really busy and hard, but I get the gift of practicing this principles in all my affairs, right? I'm sober. My kid's got what she needs. I get to let my family know I love them. I get to be in service of you. I get to be of service to our community. It was in this program that I was taught how important being of service was. This last weekend, I was able to serve Santa Maria and raise well over $100,000 so that everybody could be in the room and listen to a live orchestra and have the experience that I did when I was a kid, coming from a small town and getting into a world that I just never thought I would be a part of. How flipping cool is that? All right? It taught me to keep an open mind and keep humble, because even though two nights ago I was, right, hanging out with all the fancy pants in a really fancy pants place and everybody slanging money around, and the next night after that I was at a bonfire, right, with a whole different group of folks, right? Neither one of those groups of people would I have connected with really under normal situations. But I get to have that kind of a range today, right? I get the freedom to be me and do both. Mm-hmm. And instead of seeking out the differences between all of me and everybody else, I get to see the similarities, right? Because I know a lot of you are probably not ballet dancers, nor want to be ballet dancers, but that's not the point. We can connect on an entirely different level, and I get to hear your story and not really understand a lot of it, but I connect with the principles and these steps and what we're supposed to do with them. And I'm so grateful. I don't know if I want to end it there. That to me feels like the perfect place. I'm able, what it is like is I am able to humble myself, to be open and willing to ride this where it's going to take me, and to not pray for where I want to go, but to only pray for his will and how I can be a vessel to carry that out, be it in these rooms, around the world. And so thank you. That means the world to me. And thank you for letting me be of service and share my story tonight.
All right. Let's give Kristen another round of applause. All right. Thank you for speaking tonight, Kristen. And anybody who would like to come up after the meeting to thank the speaker is more than welcome.